Hello and welcome to Battleground 44 with me, Patrick Bishop. Today we continue our series looking at the personalities, motivations and style of the great warlords of the greatest war the world has ever seen: Adolf Hitler, Winston Churchill, Franklin D. Roosevelt and Joseph Stalin. Well, last week we heard from Giles Milton about Stalin, surely one of the most malign human beings ever to stride the world stage. Today we're going to hear about one who, whatever his flaws, was on the side of what is best and noblest in humanity. Winston Churchill was apparently coming to the end of his political life when the war broke out. In May 1940, he became Prime Minister of a Britain that was embattled and in disarray. I felt that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and this trial, he was to write later. Well, Churchill certainly rose to the occasion, bringing the nation with him. But by early 1944, 80 years ago, although it was clear that victory was at last in sight, it was also apparent that the post-war world was not going to be shaped to Churchill's liking, and that some of the crucial things he'd fought for had already been lost. Listeners are in for a great treat today, because I have with me the best possible guide to Churchill the man and Churchill the warlord. Andrew Roberts is the paramount expert on the subject, the author of what is widely regarded as the best biography to date, that is, Churchill, Walking with Destiny. It's not only a sublime work of history and biography, but also a fantastic bargain, because as many have pointed out, if you buy Andrew's book, you won't have to buy the thousand others that have been written on Churchill. Andrew, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, and thank you very much indeed for that splendid introduction.
So let's start with Churchill's statement that his life today had been a preparation for the great challenge he faced in 1940. He's unusual in our quartet of warlords in that he did indeed have some formal training for a military career. Stalin had none. Hitler was a wartime serviceman, rose no higher than Lance Corporal. And FDR, although he'd been Assistant Secretary of the Navy during the First World War, never served in uniform. So, Andrew, did Churchill's training, his first-hand knowledge of war in the Sudan and the Western Front, etc., and, of course, his background as a military historian, help him as a war leader, or was a little knowledge a dangerous thing?
Well, it wasn't, of course, just those two campaigns. He fought on four continents and in five campaigns. And one of them, the last, was actually a lieutenant colonel in the trenches. So it was much more than just sort of small colonial wars of the Victorian era. He had a direct sense of what it was like to lead men in a modern war, a modern world war. And yes, this did give him a huge insight into what the men wanted, into making sure that their creature comforts were handed out as effectively and efficiently as possible. It's interesting to see quite how many letters he writes about making sure that the men get their post and they get their beer and other essentials like that, in a way that if we had a prime minister during the war who had not been in uniform, classic example, I suppose, would be Neville Chamberlain, who started the Second World War as prime minister. I don't think that he would have been able to have looked the service chiefs in the eye and argue with them in the way that he did. The second thing that you pointed out about him being a military historian is also absolutely central. He had written many military history books, and so he also felt that this gave him the ability to draw on history to counter-argue several of the chiefs of staff over these five crucial years in which he was the wartime premier.
Now, this is interesting, isn't it? Because he did, despite the fact that his great affection for the military, his rather romantic streak, you know, where he saw war in some, you know, he saw both aspects of war, and he, as you say, he'd rightly understood from the trenches the ghastly nature of modern warfare. But there was still a part of him that thrilled to the idea of war as a sort of glorious enterprise. Yet when it came down to it, he realized that felt very, a very strong conviction that the politician had to lead, the politician had to be in the driving seat. And in that respect, he was quite dismissive of advice, wasn't he, from grand strategic advice from his military chiefs?
Well, he always took it. There's no occasion during the whole of the Second World War in which he overruled his chiefs of staff when all three of them agreed on something. So he might have been dismissive, but ultimately he didn't overrule them. One has to remember, of course, that the one of the wars that you mentioned was the Boer War, in which the generals did particularly badly. And he came away from the Boer War, in which he had been present, of course, as a war correspondent, with a very low opinion, frankly, of generals. And you're also right, of course, about his belief that despite the disgusting waste and the horror and the pity of war, he did have a romantic sense. One only has to read his great speech of the 23rd of August 1940 about the RAF, in which he coined so many famous phrases, including the one about the few, to appreciate that he did see that there was something noble and honourable in being a soldier. But with regard to the central point you make, he understood that ultimately it was ministers who had to decide, and he wasn't going to allow that to be taken over by generals in the way that the generals had dominated the grand strategy in the Great War.
What about his experience as First Lord of the Admiralty in the First World War? I mean, he'll always be associated with Gallipoli, a disaster. To what extent did he learn from that great mistake and subsequent mistakes?
Oh, hugely. It was because of Gallipoli, because of the 147,000 killed and wounded at Gallipoli, which could essentially sprung from his idea, and he had been the person who had championed it. He hadn't been the only person, obviously. The War Council had approved it back in 1915, but nonetheless, he was the person who stuck with it for the longest, believing that it was a way that essentially that Turkey could be knocked out of the war. And because of the, and it nearly ended his political career when it became clear that it was a disaster, as you say. And that was the reason that in the Second World War, he didn't overrule the chiefs of staff in the way that he had overruled admiralty advice in the First World War. He was a politician who learnt lessons, not just lessons of history, lessons of the past and the things that he'd written about, but also lessons from his own personal experience. And again, you see this in his politics, that he learns the lessons of mistakes. In fact, he says the wonderful line in January 1916, when he's writing to Clementine, his wife, from the trenches, and he said, "I should have made nothing if I had not made mistakes."
In his actual dealings with individual generals and admirals, etc., he could be pretty rough, though, couldn't he? I mean, he didn't tolerate failure for very long, or his mood could change. He could sort of promote someone and then decide actually they weren't really the person that he thought they were, etc. I'm thinking of, Wavell and then Auchinleck in the Western Desert, but also his first chief of staff, Sir John Dill, who he very quickly not lost faith in exactly, but thought, "This is not the guy I need," Dilly Dally, as he called him. Do you think he was fair in most of those judgments?
Yes, I do think he was. I mean, it wasn't a question of mood. It was a question of the fact that neither Wavell nor Auchinleck had been able to deliver victory in the Western Desert in the way that Montgomery later was able to. And with regard to Dill, he didn't think that he had the drive and energy. What he did appreciate, though, was that Dill had superb skills as a diplomat, and that's why when he sent him over to be the British liaison officer with the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington, Dill actually came into his own and was able to interact with General Marshall and the other American chiefs of staff in a hugely positive way that actually rebounded very well with regard to Churchill himself on several occasions.
But he wasn't completely consistent, was he, Andrew? You've got people like, he had favourites, so it's like Mountbatten, who one would have thought after, his early quite calamitous naval career when he was at sea, would not be the sort of person you'd look to for high command. But of course, he's head of combined operations, and he's got a seat at the highest tables. And indeed, I'm also thinking of Arthur Harris, Bomber Harris, who, although he certainly served a purpose in the first and middle stages of the war, by 1944, he's actually pulling in the opposite direction to where the Allied campaign is supposed to be going. So what about those two?
Well, and you could also probably add Ord Wingate and a few others to that list. I think with regard to Bomer Harris could pull as much as he liked, but unless the Winston Churchill and the War Cabinet also supported the combined bomber offensive over Germany, which they did, Bomer Harris would not have got the resources that he needed to carry it out. I think it's very easy to blame Bomer Harris, frankly, for decisions that ultimately are those of the War High Command, including Winston Churchill. The charge of favouritism is a fair one to an extent, but they're equally, if you were Winston Churchill's favourite, you were expected to perform better. And if you weren't, and you see this several occasions also, of course, with politicians, Bob Boothby, his great friend Bob Boothby, who he sacked, for example, Duff Cooper, who he also moved away from Minister of Information, and others, Roger Keyes, you might mention also, you were expected to perform better. And if you didn't, you got summarily moved away or even fired. So there was a positive as well as a negative, or should I say a negative as well as a positive aspect to being one of Winston Churchill's favourites.
All right, we're going to take a break there. Do join us in part two when Andrew will be talking about Churchill's relationship with Joseph Stalin. Let's move on to his dealings with his fellow warlords. Well, we know the story pretty well about Roosevelt. He'd only met him once before, slight sort of vagueness about when and where, but 1918 it seems. But once the war begins, once he's prime minister, he starts this sort of long distance wooing by telegram, which is remarkably effective. And then they meet in person in Placentia and Washington, numerous other occasions, remarkable number of encounters between them. Tell us something about the way he went about forming that very strong personal relationship, something that Churchill understood the great value of. You know, it's often said has been said by historians that, you know, the personalities don't actually play that much a part in great events. But I think the Second World War really puts that idea to the sword. And here, this relationship is, of course, absolutely fundamental. We'll come on to Stalin later, but this is the first one that he really has to make work, isn't it?
Well, that's right. You're absolutely right. Of course, personalities do matter. It's all part of this concept of the great man and woman view of history no longer pertaining. It's utter rot, as far as I'm concerned. The individuals who take these huge decisions, of course their personalities matter. There wasn't any vagueness with regard to FDR. He remembered meeting Churchill at this particular day in 1918 in the Inns of Court. It was just that Churchill didn't remember meeting FDR, which FDR understandably took a slight askance to. But by that stage, when they met in the August of 1941 for the second time, they had to get on, and thank God they did. One of the reasons, I think, is that they both came very much from the same kind of background. FDR was an aristocrat in the American term. Came from an old and rich family. Of course, his cousin had been president as well. And they very much came from the same kind of political background in terms of both being on the what one would call compassionate conservative kind of line. He was, FDR, of course, wasn't a conservative politically. He was a Democrat. But nonetheless, he was one of those who believed in ameliorating the condition of the people in the same way that Winston Churchill and Winston Churchill's father and the people they looked up to, like Disraeli, also believed in. So they didn't have a sort of internal political clash in that sense. If they'd been in each other's countries, they would have been on each other's side. Then you had the fact that they just simply liked each other's company. You know, this is a tremendously important thing in history and politics. They like being with one another. Roosevelt wouldn't have invited Churchill to stay at the White House for 3 weeks over the Christmas. of 1941, unless they'd actually got on. Churchill didn't particularly like the cocktails that Roosevelt mixed for him. Eleanor Roosevelt thought that Churchill kept her husband up far too late at night. But nonetheless, it was a wonderful personal friendship and a proper friendship.
Now, what about Stalin? I mean, there is absolutely nothing that Stalin and Churchill had in common. Yet, nonetheless, he wanted to get on with him on a personal level, not just on a one could say, you know, rather sort of cynical political level. Now, this really is extraordinary. It's not just the difference in class. It's a total discord in their worldview, in their view of humanity. Churchill hated Bolsheviks, he hated Bolshevism, and he was under no illusion about what Stalin was. Stalin was a mass murderer, that was clear, a mass murderer of his own people. Yet when he meets Stalin in Moscow in August 1942, there are some very rocky moments during the various encounters, but he did seem to be genuinely charmed by him, didn't he? He told his PPS, John Martin, that he rather liked Stalin and they had many things in common. Now, this is something that I was fascinated by reading your book, Andrew, the way that, you know, Churchill has this rather kind of tender side where he wants to be liked and he sort of wants to connect humanly, even with a monster like Stalin. Do you think he was capable of sort of deluding himself to some extent?
I don't think he deluded himself at all with regard to what Stalin had done in his life and what he was capable of. He actually asked Stalin about the massacre of the Kulaks, which Stalin had been in part responsible for, in which millions of essentially the richer class of peasants were murdered and killed and starved to death and so on in the collectivization process of the 1930s. And Stalin just sort of shrugged and talked about how these people had simply disappeared. Well, Churchill knew perfectly well that they hadn't simply disappeared. And later on in the war in 1943, Churchill was given by a diplomat called Owen O'Malley absolutely cast iron evidence that Stalin had been responsible for the murder of 14,000 Polish officers in the Katyn forest, had given the order for that. And of course, the British government could not accept that publicly because they were our ally. In fact, the Foreign Office even admitted that it was true until the year 1980. But half a century or so, 40 years or so after the horror of what had happened to these poor men back in 1940. But what Churchill also knew was that he had to get on with Stalin, that he had to make as good a impression as possible, which he did at their first meeting in the Kremlin when he slapped Stalin down for accusing the British of being cowards for not starting up the Second Front. And that was the meeting in 1942. They also then basically made up over a huge amount of vodka in Stalin's flat in the Kremlin. And Churchill believed that he could outdrink Stalin and wound up with a massive headache the next day when he had to fly off. But nonetheless, he did, as you say, have a working relationship, a good working relationship. He did say that terrible thing to John Martin, I like that man, about somebody who, when you started off this show, you rightly pointed out was one of the most evil men who ever lived. So this is something that one has to deal with, frankly, if you're a Churchill biographer. He did put the Realpolitik necessary before his lifelong opposition to communism. You know, he hated communism, hated Bolshevism. Some of the remarks that he made in the 1920s and 30s about Bolshevism are some of the most histrionic, but also factual, of his entire career. So yes, there is there's a dichotomy there, and I think it can only be explained in terms of what Realpolitik demanded of any British Prime Minister at that stage in world history. And you see in the October of 1944, when he goes back to Kremlin, what that Realpolitik is capable of, because that's the point at which he writes out the what's called the percentages agreement, the naughty document, as Stalin called it, which essentially gave 90% of control to Stalin over those areas that the Red Army already had 90% control over, or 100%, and managed to save Greece for democracy.
Okay, let's move forward to the situation in 1944. So Churchill succeeded in his great aim of bringing America into the war and in keeping Stalin fighting. However, in the intervening years, his status among the Allied triumvirate has diminished somewhat, as has become clear at the Tehran Conference in November 1943, where the three gather to thrash out the direction of the final phases of the war, and crucially, what comes afterwards. It's clear there that Stalin and FDR have their own ideas about the shape of the post-war world, and it's not really much to Churchill's liking, is it?
No, because it's clear both to FDR and to Stalin that that Russia and America are going to be the superpowers that emerge from the Second World War, and the British Empire isn't. And Churchill, who had dedicated his whole life up until then to the British Empire, obviously didn't like that. And he makes a few jokes about the Russian bear and the American buffalo, but it's actually the English donkey who sees the right way through to victory. But nonetheless, he does recognize, I think also in that statement, you know, the donkey versus the bear and the buffalo, that that Britain is not going to emerge from the Second World War anything like as strongly as it did, as it entered it, and that therefore the United States, which was by that stage in 1944 outproducing Britain and indeed Russia and Germany altogether in terms of warplane production, for example, that of course the United States was going to be one superpower and that Russia was going to be the other. So he didn't like that. Of course, he didn't.
Yeah, but there's also the you know, the very sad aspect that Eastern Europe, or Poland in particular, is going to be removed under this new order from the sphere of European democracy and civilization, as understood by Churchill. And of course, this was the casus belli. This is why we went to war in the first place. To what extent do you think that was a sadness for him, and at the time, and indeed after the war?
Well, after the war, clearly it was. I mean, that's the gravamen of the whole gist, really, of the Iron Curtain speech. But in the January and February of 1945, he still, somewhat naively, I think, believed that there was a chance that Poland was going to get its independence and integrity back, not least because Stalin promised that that was going to be the case at the Yalta Conference, where he promised a lot of things. It turned out, of course, that Stalin was lying through his teeth, both to Churchill and to Roosevelt, and both men chose to believe it. It was there was not much they could do, frankly, one way or the other. There were millions of Red Army boots on the ground in Poland and no Allied boots. So even if he had denounced Stalin for lying at Yalta rather than choosing to believe his lies, there was absolutely nothing that either the British or the Americans could have done about it.
Even though we did emerge from the war in a diminished state, we had actually won it, we'd been on the winning side, etc. But looking back, do you think there was any other political figure on the scene at the time who could have got a better result, if you like?
Oh, no. Most other people who could have become prime minister, Anthony Eden, of course, Lord Beaverbrook, they'd have had to have come from the conservative side of the house because there was a massive conservative majority there. So it's not something that you can take into account, Attlee or Ernest Bevin. But none of these people would have been able to have got as good a deal as Winston Churchill did. He had enormous prestige by the time of the end of the war. The fact that he lost the general election during the Potsdam Conference was down to the British way of having a parliamentary system whereby he was only one person who stood in 635 constituencies. If we'd had a presidential system, he could well have won it, but we don't.
Now, let's fast forward to the present day, if you don't mind, Andrew. I'm just thinking about where Churchill would have stood on Ukraine.
Oh, he'd have seen immediately in Putin the kind of figure that he saw in Stalin, not in the Stalin of 1942 or 1944, who he thought of as a heroic figure, but the Stalin of 1946, who was already grinding his heel down on the freedoms of everyone in Eastern Europe. He would undoubtedly have seen the invasion of the 24th of February 2022 as a hostile act along the lines of Hitler's invasion of the Sudetenland and Poland and the Rhineland and so on, and would have recognised that it's very much in Britain's interest and NATO's interest to go to the support of Ukraine and make sure that this monstrous invasion doesn't bear Putin fruit.
Interesting. It was a pleasure to have you on our show, Andrew. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Patrick. I've much enjoyed it.
Well, that was absolutely fascinating. Do join us on Friday when Saul and I will be digging into all the latest from Ukraine. Goodbye.